You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On Wednesday of last week, Army Sergeant Vanessa Turner, who just returned from Iraq, was rushed to the hospital suffering from what appeared to be a heart attack. Turner has been in a fight for her life and the survival of her daughter since she recovered in a hospital in Germany. On May 18th, 70 miles from Baghdad in the town of Balad, Army Sergeant Vanessa Turner succumbed to what appeared to be pneumonia. She was medevaced to Germany, where she fell into a coma. Within approximately 24 hours of arriving in Germany, Army Sergeant Vanessa Turner had been medically retired from the military. From that day until today, it is unclear who made the decision or why. Peace Watch editor Lona Elias has this report.
On May 19, 2003, Beverly Turner received a call from Army Sergeant Algiers of the Casualty Affairs Department informing her that her daughter, Army Sergeant Vanessa Turner, was ill and had been classified by the military as in danger of, quote, imminent death, with the expectation that she would live only 36 to 72 hours. In the same conversation, Sergeant Algiers suggested that Miss Turner fly to Germany to be with her daughter, but that Army Sergeant Turner had been medically retired, so the military would not pay for their travel expenses and their family was responsible for getting to Germany, quote, the best way they could, end quote. According to Ms. Turner, Algiers went on to say that Sergeant Turner had been retired because it entitled her surviving young daughter to receive greater benefits than would be available if Sergeant Turner died while still on active duty. In fact, Sergeant Turner has survived and is recovering, but because there are no Army bases in Boston, Massachusetts, Army Sergeant Turner and her daughter, as of today, are homeless. Sergeant Turner's family contacted the American Legion to investigate the claim that greater benefits would occur to her surviving dependent child as a result of medical retirement. Peace Watch spoke with Steve Smithson, Assistant Director of the American Legion's Veteran Affairs and Rehabilitation Commission, to ascertain whether the medical retirement of soldiers within a short period of time is a new procedure or general practice.
That's one of the things we're looking into. I'd never heard of them doing it in the past, and this first case that I heard about when I made the inquiry, I was, you know, I never heard of this happening before, so I was surprised, found out that they are actually doing it. And I don't know how new the policy is, but it is the first time I've heard of them doing that.
When Sergeant Turner sought medical treatment in July, she was advised that she would have to wait until October before she could get an appointment for orientation. Orientation simply informs the veteran of the procedures of the Veteran Administration and is required before receiving any medical treatment. Smithson advised that when Turner called to request an appointment, her status was misclassified. We asked him to explain.
From my understanding, I don't think they knew she was a recent returnee from the Second Gulf War, for one thing, or that her disabilities were obviously service-related. Apparently that was clarified, but her situation points to an even bigger problem with in the VA healthcare system right now, is there is an extremely large backlog nationwide. Hundreds of thousands of veterans waiting long periods of time to get initial appointments, and her whole initial experience was an example of that.
We asked Smithson, why is the American Legion involved in this particular case?
We're concerned. You know, the military is saying that obviously they're doing it for you know, because it's better for the service member, because they will receive greater benefits, or their dependents will receive greater benefits. And we just, you know, we've never heard of them doing this before, and we'd just like some clarification and to know specifically which benefits would be greater. We're going to press until we get the answers to this, because it doesn't necessarily sound right. And when they give a general answer, well, because the person will receive greater benefits, well, that's fine. Which benefits are greater? And we haven't gotten the answer. I initially inquired about 2 weeks ago, and the person I was going through was supposed to get back to me, hasn't gotten back to me yet.
In spite of numerous calls to the Department of Defense regarding Turner and other cases, no one has been willing to go on the record to answer the question of what compelling interests of greater benefits to the families justified the medical retirement and the ensuing suffering of their families as a result thereof. Sergeant Turner is only one instance. We will continue to follow this case and provide updates as the story develops. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Lona Elias.
And we end today's show with the story of Vietnam veteran and renowned peace activist Brian Wilson, who spoke recently in Los Angeles about his experiences of war and U.S. military intervention abroad. Peace Watch presents this special word and music mix, beginning with musician Bill Withers.
We recorded this song on October the 6th. Since then, the war has been declared over. If you're like me, you'll remember it like anybody remembers any war. One big drag. A lot of people write songs about wars and government, very social things. But I think about young guys who were like I was when I was young. I had no more idea about any government or political things or anything. And I think about those kind of young guys now who all of a sudden somebody comes up and they're very law-abiding.
During bayonet training, we were supposed to shout, "Kill," 100 times as we plunged the bayonet into these dummies in front of us. And I paused for a moment as the other 20 officers proceeded to plunge their bayonets into the dummy, shouting "kill" as loud as they could. And there was something about the whole notion that I was resisting, but I did want to do it. I did not want to be different. I did not want to not do it. So I hesitated just long enough that the sergeant that was training us in this bayonet drill came up and shouted in my ear, "Did you hear that order?" I said, "Yes, sir." And I was fully prepared to begin the plunging of my bayonet into the dummy, and I paused a little longer because it obviously was something I was struggling with, and the sergeant then kicked me in the calf and my legs buckled, and so I was down on the ground on my knees, and I said, "Well, I'm not going to do this drill now." And I didn't do it. And I thought, well, this is going to identify me as a wimp, and I'm going to be identified in some way that's going to give me a problem in the Air Force. Well, actually, nothing happened from that, except that I did explain to our commander that I had a problem thinking I was going to be bayoneting people in Vietnam, and he simply said, "It's too bad you didn't do the drill because you might have to do hand-to-hand combat in Vietnam and you won't know how to defend yourself." And it was left virtually at that.
Boot camp, we had classes. You know, we talked about fighting every day.
When I returned to the States, I was assigned to a supply squadron in Louisiana. And I was assigned an Air Force Defense Counsel to represent me for the anticipated court-martial. And while I was in Louisiana in the supply squadron as the executive officer, I was charged with 25 or 27 more counts for conduct that I was participating in Louisiana in anti-war activities on weekends. Well, to make a long story shorter about the military, I got through that year with no court-martial. All the charges were simply dismissed or were simply forgotten. My Air Force Defense Counsel told me that if they had brought a court-martial against me, I would have been able to testify about the bombings of all these villages and what I had witnessed. And he did not think the military wanted to give me a forum in which to talk about that that would be covered by the press.
Would you please write a letter to my mother? Tell her to tell the family lawyer. Trying to get a deferment for my younger brother.
I had to deal with being a Vietnam veteran. For 12 years, I hadn't told people I had been in Vietnam. I didn't want people to know that I'd been in Vietnam. I felt disgusted about it. I felt embarrassed about it. I felt ashamed that I hadn't known better. I know it's not cool to not, you know, be able to forgive yourself and just acknowledge that you were brainwashed. Well, I realized that I wanted to go public after these flashbacks and talk about the fact that we are brainwashed and we have to take responsibility for being truth speakers. And the only way to heal is to tell the truth. And that we invaded Vietnam, we have invaded many other countries and intervened, all in violation of international law, and that we were so wrapped up in our nationalism and our personal identity that we weren't able to think outside the box, weren't able to be critical of policies that were clearly criminal and insane, and have to admit, I was so conditioned as to not be able to be a human being. I mean, that's kind of hard to do that. But if you want to get on with your life and heal, you have to integrate all that past with the lessons and opportunities that it provides you to learn. So I became much more politically active and said, no more Vietnams. And by that time, I realized we had already intervened in the history of our country 300 or 400 times overtly and several thousand times covertly. And I surmised, after much reading, that probably all of those interventions, virtually all the interventions, probably were similar to, in some manner and kind, to Vietnam. As some of you probably know, the entire foundation of this civilization is make-believe. I mean, we did steal the land at gunpoint and killed millions. We stole labor at gunpoint and killed millions, and we stole resources from all over the world and killed millions. Basically, we're the beneficiaries of a massive system of theft and violence and exploitation. Not that other empires haven't been similar. However, I was told the United States was the greatest country in the history of the world, and I was discovering that it had its own hidden history that was very dark. In fact, it was getting harder and harder to find any chapter of American history that I had been told and taught that was very redeemable. There certainly are interesting movements in the history of the country and interesting countercultural developments and anti-slavery and suffrage and so forth, but the prevailing value system has never really been broken around greed, private property, selfishness, exploitation. These things have been very difficult for me to come to terms with because I had to give up this good feeling I had that really can carry you for a long ways despite the facts that you're learning. Just a feeling, it's the security, a feeling of belonging. We had developed the A-bomb on July 17th at Alamogordo, the successful test, which gave us this new ace, which enabled us to be much more cocky at Potsdam, which started on July 17th. So we could confidently say we're partitioning Korea and stop the communist advance, as was touted. Now, we know from looking at U.S. intelligence estimates that were done on the Korean population in 1944 and 45, two significant conclusions. One is that the Korean people had been terribly, terribly repressed by the Japanese occupation, and that the Korean people were passionately willing and ready and able to govern themselves and were looking for the opportunity to begin that process. The second conclusion was that most Koreans favored a socialist form of government rather than a Western form of government called capitalism. It was very clearly, it's clearly articulated in U.S. intelligence materials that you can find in the archives. Despite that, the United States Army military government in Korea that was formed in September of 1945 outlawed the new government, outlawed labor organizing, outlawed student organizing, and outlawed women's organizations from being political. And by 1947, there was beginning expressions of dissent among South Koreans against the U.S. occupation that became very visible and very uncomfortable for the U.S. occupiers, who by that time had incorporated some of the Japanese who had been part of the administration of the Japanese occupation, and many of the Koreans that had collaborated with the Japanese and the police and certain administrative functions. We incorporated most of those people into our military government. You could look at almost any country in Africa, Asia, or Latin America and come up with a pretty dark history of U.S. policy. It's the truth. You can pick your country and study it. But in Korea, like in Vietnam, 5 million were killed. Korea seemingly permanently divided. One of the major crimes of the 20th century still not resolved. What the United States did to Korea, what the United States did to Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, that is beyond the comprehension of most U.S. American people to grasp. What it's like to destroy ancient cultures, what it's like to pulverize societies into small pebbles and not feel the pain of that kind of inflicted damage on other people. I mean, after all, they're human beings. So I just think of Korea as a case study, as a metaphor, in a sense, for our whole history of our behavior, behavior that we have to examine, behavior that we have to look at in ourselves. What is it about us that can feel so comfortable? We're the only country that has troops in 150 other countries in the world. We control space. We control air spaces as well as outer space. We control the seas. We have 60% of all weapons of mass destruction that are in the world. We're the only nation that has used nuclear weapons. Well, obviously, I don't believe that we're an exceptionally good society. We are exceptionally in denial. We are exceptionally spoiled. We are creating a globalized model of capitalism that will destroy the planet, destroy cultures, destroy the air, destroy the water, destroy the soil, destroy the human spirit. And yet we have, as human beings, the total capacity to break out of the box, to become fully human, transcending nation-state ideologies, transcending this notion of loyalty to the nation-state and citizenship when it means turning away from truth. The structural problem that we have to face is kind of ominous. We have 4.5% of the world's population, but we consume anywhere from 1/4 to 1/2 the world's resources, depending on the resource we look at. That requires theft at gunpoint. It requires an enforced unfairness in the distribution of resources. We continue to do that believing that we deserve it, that we are worth more and they're worth less. But in fact, we are not worth more and they are not worth less. Nobody is. We haven't had our first real revolution yet in the United States. We had a revolution that we talk about, the American Revolution, but it was the Brits here against the Brits in England. It was to break free of monarchical rule for the people who had land in this country. It was not a revolution around class, and we still, as a society, don't acknowledge that we have a serious class problem in addition to a race problem. That we aren't able politically to deal honestly with class issues. It's called justice. Amazing thing that we have an unelected person in the White House. I mean, I still think that's one incredible thing that we haven't really dealt with yet. We have an unelected person in the White House that we call president. He has identified North Korea as a member of the Axis of Evil. He has identified Korea as a potential target for preemptive strikes using nuclear weapons. If you were a country and had the biggest bully country in the world that had all these weapons of mass destruction targeting you, I wonder how you would feel and think, and whether you would be worrying about your future and defending yourself from that kind of attack. I have this faith that we are able and capable of having an explosion of our consciousness, call it a quantum leap, if you will, as an alternative to the suicide of extinction. How do you break the cycle? And I think that perhaps Bush is a cosmic gift in disguise. He makes it so easy, or he makes it easier, to detect problems with this model that we have. He has unmasked the language. We will have a desire, that we will have a desire as never before to find our humanity and to say to the world, we're sorry. We're sorry for all we've done to inflict this pain and this misery, and begin wailing, if you will, in tears. Because when you realize what you've done that has been so painful, you do cry. As I have cried many times,
in 34 years since I was in Vietnam for having committed so much harm from so much ignorance, and to realize that my whole civilization is built on killing the indigenous, killing Africans, and then killing people all over the world that were in the way of our getting what we wanted on our terms. It's quite a history. It's not a sustainable history. It's not a sustainable model. And I'm interested myself in living in a sustainable world. So I'm hoping that all of us will recognize the need for our own quantum leap, our own revolution, if you will, of consciousness that will carry us with our imagination and with courage in places that we can't imagine at this moment, but that will liberate us from our own box. Thank you.
Vietnam veteran Brian Wilson spoke recently in California. He was recorded by Dave Adelson and the LA Sound Posse. His speech was mixed with music from Bill Withers, live at Carnegie Hall, the Funk Brothers, and Marvin Gaye, and was produced by Anthony Sloan. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Matt Bradley, Sam Husseini, Benta Berklin, Reem Kathuda, Mohammed Galini, and Kata Mester. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support, however, that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.